It is Tuesday, January 1st, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Happy New Year. On this first day of 2013, we have one of our book club editions of the program. We talk to authors about their latest books. In a moment, Kevin Phillips, a familiar voice to public radio listeners. For years, he was a commentator on Morning Edition, as well as other NPR news magazine programs. He's written for Harper's, Times, and the Los Angeles Times, and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2000 for his book, The Cousins' War. His latest book, Years in the Making, is titled 1775, A Good Year for Revolution. And later on this edition of Ozarks, John Holmans, the executive editor of New York Magazine. He'll discuss his newest book, his first full-length book, actually, What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. And then still later, from Arkansas, Dr. Matthew Pate talks about his new book about the use of pain by cultures and governments around the planet as punishment. It's titled Corporal Punishment Around the World. That and more ahead on this book club edition of Ozarks at Large for January 1st, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. There is a tendency to catalog events by single years. Mention 1929, and most of us will instantly think of the stock market crash and the resulting depression. 1776, of course, has its own place in American history, the revolution that led to independence. Historians will correct that myopic view of the past, though. The crash of 29 or the signing of the Declaration of Independence did not happen as spontaneous events. There is a trail leading to Wall Street and Philadelphia. It's the road to independence that Kevin Phillips examined in his new book, 1775, A Good Year for Revolution, a wonderful book that layers the developments that become American independence. Kevin Phillips is with me on the phone. Welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Happy to be here.
When most of us consider the Revolution, we do think of that mythical year, 1776. But 1775, as you point, had so many occurrences, large, small, political, military, that leads us to this revolutionary atmosphere. And many of those are events that we do not learn about, are they?
That's the thing. As I was working on this, I found myself with a kind of chronological backward creep going on. I would see that it wasn't just May or June of 1775, it was edging back towards 1774. The thing is, the whole notion of 1776 as being the critical year is largely predicated on July 4th and the role of the Declaration of Independence. And as you get beyond that, as you push that myth, that exaggeration aside, you begin to see that the revolution had about a year and a half, even more than that, before the Declaration of Independence, in which it was gestating.
When I read 1775, the thing that amazed me the most is that these colonies ever could coalesce. There are so many issues between what passed for urban then and rural, and just the story of how they have to come together in that era is fascinating.
Well, it's a complicated one because you have to look at regional differences. New England was pretty strongly for the revolution. The plantation colonies from Maryland down to the Carolinas were reasonably strongly for the revolution. The middle colonies, particularly New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, were very ambivalent. They could see that perhaps if all went well a century later, the British Empire might have its seat of ruling power and influence in New York or Philadelphia. The others could not see anything like that. So from the standpoint of New England and the plantation colonies, They were beginning to move that way in 1774. They moved strongly in 1775. They really had to push the middle colonies. And that's the second story. It wasn't enough that two-thirds of the colonies were pretty strongly in motion by mid-1775. They still had to take some fence-sitters and push them off the fence.
It's such an obvious observation to say that things were so different, the lack of the instant communication that we know now. But when you just examine the populations in 1775, the urban centers of this of the colonies, maybe 35,000 people in Philadelphia, 25,000 in New York, your book really lets us know that these were such different times. And sometimes we forget that, I think.
We forget it because, of course, we have no sense of what it would have been like to be in the 13 colonies when their total population added up to about 2.7 million. But having said that, if you look at Europe, the 2.7 million in the colonies was bigger than the population in Switzerland, in Holland, I would think in Denmark, not too far behind that of Prussia. You were looking at colonies that had become a focal point of Europe. People in Europe thought that the reason the British had become such a power was partly because of these colonies and their resources and their just massively growing population. So although it was small by our present yardsticks in the context of what people in Europe thought and what people in America were starting to think, it was a fast-growing area with the potential to change the balance of world power.
And as you mentioned, the revolution, you can go to 1775, 1774, but as you point out, really, you can see seeds of certain events developing decades even before that.
Well, that's true. There are some people that have looked back and they've seen the psychological watershed developing in the 13 colonies in 1763 and 1764. When the British, who had just finished what we call the French and Indian War, what was called the 7 Years' War in Europe, at that point in time, the British were beginning to think they had to do something to put the colonies in their place. They were getting too big. Population wanted to move west of the Appalachians. Their maritime sector was too strong. It was giving competition to the British. They wanted to manufacture things in the 13 colonies that Britain wanted to ship there in a colonial system. So they started leaning, and part of how they leaned was to talk about taxes. Other ways in which the problem was becoming acute was not letting people or steering them away from going to the important colonies and trying to push them in the direction of maritime provinces of Canada and down into Florida. They just didn't like what was taking shape. And people in the colonies sensed this in 1763 and 1764, and attitudes were really beginning to change. No longer was the mother country the affectionately regarded power of yesteryear. It was starting to be a bit of a threat.
I think the book is worth picking up just for the 21st chapter alone, which discusses the invasion of Canada, which has long been popularly, I think, believed to be this sort of misstep in the whole process.
Well, that's right. And that's, again, part of the 1776 focus. Because if you're a historian or a reader and you're focused on 1776 and the whole 4th of July is the pivot of everything, the first thing you see with Canada is that the American troops are straggling back in the spring of 1776. They've lost the battle to capture the citadel of Quebec, and they've been squeezed out of Canada. But if you go back and you look at what was happening in 1774, but in this case, especially in 1775, you're looking at an invasion that almost succeeded. There were Indian leaders, Canadian tribal chieftains, who actually visited Washington and his camp outside of Boston in 1775 and said that they would be with the Americans if they invaded Quebec, as Canada was principally at that point. Another reason why Washington wanted to invade was to get the cannon from the Citadel of Quebec that he could use to force the British out of Boston. And again, the British were petrified. There are a number of communications, and these are well known by historians, that show that people in Quebec City in November and even early December were afraid that it was bound to fall. The Americans would take it over. Now, as long as the British were worried about losing Canada, it kept the pressure off Washington and all the troops in Massachusetts that were besieging Boston. So it was an integral part of a colonial strategy, basically to push the British north into Canada for the center of their preoccupation and to encircle them in Boston where they were trapped. And this was a disaster for British planners, but historians who don't go back and look at it from the dimension of what was being done in 1775 that had so much promise in Canada just don't get it at all.
And one last, perhaps really unfair question, more general, how long before a historian can get a firm grasp of an era? I mean, there are already books and lengthy articles dissecting a presidential election that's not yet 2 months old. Is there a certain amount of time that a historian needs to get a broader, fuller picture?
Well, I would say in this case there really is, because the whole thing has been so tilted to 1776 that even historians who specialize in the Revolution tend not to know very much about all these things that added up to an entirely different revolution if you just look at them from a perspective of 1775 and 1774. You have to get to the point where you're thinking sort of across the board with a whole spectrum of things, with each of the colonies, with what the British were doing, with what Congress was doing. And since it hasn't been a focus, it really takes quite a while. I would say I was in my third year of concentrating on this before I could begin to have a sort of view. Well, this is the third week in May of 1775. What was happening where? What were the British doing? What were the Americans doing? What was happening in the different provinces? Up until that point, you sort of share in the disjointed view of not much going on. And it comes hard to see all of a sudden, or not all of a sudden, but to see it accumulating in a way that you haven't seen it before.
You have to be immersed, it sounds like.
Yes, in a nutshell. Immersion is necessary.
Kevin Phillips' book is 1775, A Good Year for Revolution. Thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you for talking with me.
Ahead on this book club edition of a January 1st Ozarks at Large, John Holmans. He's the executive director of New York Magazine, and his first nonfiction book is titled What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. It's just been published, and we'll talk to him in just a few minutes. And later, Dr. William Pate, an Arkansas native, talks about the use of corporal punishment around the world. Those conversations and more ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. Mother Nature herself has become a permanent fixture at Hobbs State Park Conservation Area in Benton County. Every second Saturday and second Wednesday of the month, she visits the park to excite the imaginations of all the children around her by reading stories of the forest and the animals that live there. Reading dates this month are Wednesday the 9th and Saturday the 12th. Mother Nature will begin 2013 with stories about our Northwest Arkansas animals that hibernate. For more information, 789-5000. And the Intervention Sciences Laboratory is looking for adults, those people 21 and over, who have experienced a traumatic life event and who currently drink alcohol. This study involves two visits to the laboratory that will involve a number of tasks, including completing two interviews with a researcher and a guided imagery task. Eligible participants will be compensated. If you're interested in participating or learning more about the study, you can contact Sarah Bajarski at 575-5811. This is Ozarks at Large.
At All Things Considered, we don't just bring you the day's news. We interview actors, musicians, and artists of all stripes and take the time to understand what really drives them. We learn the story behind the story to get at the deeper truths that connect us all. I'm Melissa Block. Stop by for your daily dose of discovery every afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 3 until 6 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Happy New Year's. This is a book club edition of Ozarks at Large. John Holmans is the executive editor of New York Magazine, a post he's held since 1994. He had previously worked at Esquire, Details, Harper's, and the New York Observer. He lives in Manhattan, and he says the last thing he thought he would have written about for his first full-length nonfiction book, dogs. But that's just what he did. What's a dog for? The surprising history, science, philosophy, and politics of man's best friend is John Holman's first book. Recently, I talked to him about the work. He says that there is a lot of science that goes into studying the behavior of dogs. He says there's even new research into the evolution of dogs and how they became domesticated.
The reigning theory of dog evolution was that the wolves that became dogs were wolves that lost their fear of humans, or wolves that important concept is flight distance, that would allow humans to come closer without running away, and that enabled them to get the mammoth bones or whatever, what have you, reindeer bones or whatever they happened to be hunting. So they hung out and waited. They probably helped hunt too, and Stella is she would have been fantastic at that primitive activity.
Stella, of course, your dog, a lab.
A lab mix.
And at one point, you point out that the lab is like the kid who waits to be called on, as opposed to the border collie, who is the know-it-all kid who can't
Absolutely.
Wait to show you.
I think that's what the English noblemen, the dukes and such, very rich English people that bred the lab, like about the lab is that it's a little more unassuming and not as obsessive as a border collie, even though border collies are really very bright. I hope Stella doesn't hear this, but I think the border collies are a little brighter than Stella, maybe.
The subtitle of the book is The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. So you think, I think many people know of Darwin's love and interest in dogs, but the names that come in here, not just Darwin, but Jane Goodall, Pavlov, of course, B.F. Skinner, Noam Chomsky is mentioned in relation.
Well, the most interesting thing I found, and I was delighted to discover this, and people knew, of course, that Jane Goodall was interested in her dogs, but science had moved away from thinking animals were very intelligent at all for ever since the scientists right after Darwin was, and then it was Jane Goodall that began to think again about what animal intelligence might be. And just as for Darwin, Jane Goodall was inspired by her dog named Rusty, a very bright little dog that she called. She treated him like a person, and she thought he was a person, and she thought that she had this whole quiver of human-like intelligence and emotions. And that experience primed Jane Goodall to see what she saw in the chimps at Gombe, where she anthropomorphized them, and she saw that they had these familial relationships, and she saw really how similar they were to humans. And it was a dog, just as for Darwin, it was a dog that kind of catalyzed that insight. And I find that really fascinating. And dogs are still a lot. Then I wrote about some scientists who are primate scientists who are trying to find out how humans evolved from primates. And the dog it provides an example in that the tameness of the dog seems to have equipped it to better communicate with humans. And these scientists, Michael Hare and Mike Tomasello, think that humans must have become tame in a similar way. For instance, to use language, it's an activity that requires tameness. It requires believing that another creature is going to help you and not compete with you, and that's something that humans have, and that's something that dogs have, and something that, although chimps are very intelligent, much more intelligent than dogs, a chimp can't understand pointing because a chimp is competitive, and so it's something we share with dogs, and it's part of what sort of underlies our relationship. The dog is ready to be helped.
Well, and you discuss in the book What's a Dog For, the idea whether dogs have shame or guilt. We dog owners think they do, right? We're familiar with that pose.
Dog owners think they do, and most scientists think that they don't. But what they do have is they have a kind of armature of this. They have a primitive version of something that can be called shame. They know when they may get punished, and they display. Characteristics that you'd say are shameful, which is why they think they're shame. But it's more, they probably don't have the insight that they've done, a fully developed insight that they've done something that they should be ashamed of. They simply know that this outcome may produce this, what the knocked over trash may produce this outcome, and so they better put their head down and push their ears back. So it's simpler, but it's kind of on the road to into something that could be called shame, I would say.
There's an interesting bit in the book about oxytocin and how that molecule can be increased in humans when they're interacting with their dogs, especially if they're looking at their dogs.
Right. It's the basic. Well, oxytocin is of course is incredibly important. It's the basic human bonding. Hormone. It's the hormone that's most important in a mother's relationship with her baby. It fills you with warmth and love for your closest family members. And interestingly, oxytocin tends to be prejudiced against people that aren't your family members. Some scientists have found which is interesting. Petting a dog produces oxytocin in the same way interacting with a dog produces oxytocin in the same way that interacting with a spouse or a child does. And it's this basic, it creates the same kind of bond. So they're, on a chemical level, a dog and a person are kind of indistinguishable, which is interesting, and which is another reason why they fit into. I mean, it works with all pets, of course, but it's one reason why dogs fit so neatly into the human world.
Obviously, it's interesting what you write about dogs, but there's also much interesting about humans here, especially this scientific canine world that exists. It's a small world, people doing research. They know each other, and sometimes there are rivalries.
Sure. No, I'm writing about the debate over how, there's a big debate over, still a big debate over how smart animals are and what animal intelligence is and how it can be used to train animals. And it's very complicated, and there are people, there are generational differences. And the scientists I was just speaking about, the ones who are studying pointing, they've moderated some of their claims about animal intelligence, but they think that dogs are pretty special and bright, whereas an older generation, brilliant guy named Raymond Coppinger, who really devised the the most elegant and I believe true and the reigning theory of how dogs evolve, which is that they domesticated themselves and weren't first kept as pets. But he tends to think that dogs are much more less intelligent and more instinctive creatures, and believes that there's a lot of sentimentalism in dog science. And I think this Brian Hare and Mike Tomasello, I don't think, are sentimentalists, but I think that there can be sentimentalism and wishful thinking about what dogs might be capable of. That the science has to, you know, the scientists have to be careful about letting that creep in.
Well, even if scientists can manage to remove sentimentalism about the research, often the press does not when reporting about the research.
No, I think that's true. I mean, I'm sure I myself will be accused of that, but that's okay. You know, and I also think the other truth is about dogs that one wouldn't want to remove the sentimentalism in one's own relationship with one's dog, because that's part of the point. And that's why this is an interesting science, because there is this you know, we have a relationship with our dogs that are sentimental and that are involved in fantasy, and everyone, I me included, talk to their dogs. And yet you want to try to figure out, and it's hard in that context to do science, because science demands more kind of clarity. And that's the fascinating thing about the science, is that you're working with this built-in issue.
And over the last centuries, dogs have become more family members than ever before, in the house, often allowed in the bed. We tend to have this odd paradox with our dogs. At one point, giving them credit for being smart, for doing perhaps something that isn't really that smart, but at the other time, concentrating on just how smart they're not.
Mm-hmm.
It's an odd relationship we have with our dogs sometimes.
No, it's true. It can include all those things, and that's part of why that's part of what it makes it complicated and interesting. I mean, the question of what's a dog for has a lot of answers, and sometimes, as you say, sometimes I'm just marveling at Stella's, you know, at her incredible sensitivity to the natural world, and sometimes I'm saying, well, Stella, why don't you understand this simple thing, and making fun of her about it. So yeah, it's complicated and fun, and that's part of what makes the book fun, is all this. And what makes this a relationship. Dogs are really mirrors of human concerns, and that's a big part of what the book is about. Is that the dog is part of? It's this really rich, ancient culture, our relationship with dogs, and that's what I found fascinating and contradictory and fascinating, and that's what is most interesting about my book, I think.
And finally, in the acknowledgments, you write that the secret of a dog is that it's ready to be helped, and that explains so much about the dogs we love.
No, that's the basic. It explains the science of pointing, and that, you know, it's what chimpanzees can't do is be helped, and it explains the kinds of treats I'm giving, the piece of steak I'm slipping to Stella under the table when no one's watching. It's a big part of the story, and it's a lot of what people love to take, people need to take care of things, and if you don't have a child, a dog is a great thing, and even if you do. So, yeah, explains quite a bit.
The name of the book is What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. John, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
John Holmans is the executive editor of New York Magazine. His book is What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. Still to come on this book club edition of Ozarks at Large for the first day of 2013, Dr. Matthew Pate discusses the use of corporal punishment around the world. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large. Thank you. This is Ozarks at Large. Pine Bluff resident Matthew Pate is the author of a new book titled Corporal Punishment Around the World. It's a text that provides an overview of those practices in various cultures and by various governments that inflict pain to curb misconduct. Malcolm Glover, with our content partner KUAR in Little Rock, recently talked with Matthew Pate about the book.
Pate was raised in Whitehall, Arkansas, and for about a decade, he's had a multifaceted law enforcement career, including a stint as a field agent for the Arkansas Crime Information Center. Pate starts the interview with details about the genesis of the book.
Well, actually, we kind of stumbled into it. My co-author and I, Lori Gould from Georgia Southern, met at a annual meeting of the American Society of Criminology. We began talking and decided that, well, we had a shared affinity for the work of the French social philosopher Michel Foucault. And as we continued to discuss things, it always came back to Foucault's seminal work, Discipline and Punish. And that work explores the transformation of punishment in pre-industrial Europe through the Industrial Revolution. Nations of the world today are relatively industrialized, at least certainly with regard to their position 200 or 300 years ago. Some nations still use corporal punishment as a sanction for criminal offenders, and some don't. And so that's really the question is, how do you get to that place as a society where these sort of vestigial apparatuses of justice still seem relevant?
It's very fascinating. What I like is how you're able to take such a broad topic and kind of track it not only through history, but all of its facets, because corporal punishment, whether we talk about it in the home, in education, in different communities, it's very different.
Very much so. And the moment that you start looking for broad general rules, you're immediately disappointed, because what you see is that there is a collection of effects that sort of ebb and flow throughout history that either support or retard the use of corporal punishment, not only in criminal justice, but across a whole variety of social venues, whether we're talking about it as an element of religious practice or religious bureaucracy, or we're talking about it as an element of education or discipline within the family and the home. A lot of different influences sort of shift in dominance or importance across cultures and across time.
Absolutely. And even in Arkansas, I mean, we still have schools, grade schools here in this state that still practice corporal punishment. I like how you talk about the techniques of punishment. And on page 30, there's this fascinating statement. It says, "The global history of corporal punishment has been an exercise in finding the tolerances of the human body." Things continue to change. And I guess people try to find a way to curb certain behavior or certain practices.
Oh, well, yes, and indeed that's the fundamental nature of punishment, is exploring sort of two dimensions. What is sufficient to curb the undesired behavior, but is still within the tolerances of society, including the tolerances of the individual body. Just to address your point about corporal punishment in Arkansas, here we see a very strong connection between the Protestant Reformation and, I guess you could say, modalities of punishment. If you look throughout Renaissance Europe, the educators of Renaissance Europe are strongly influenced by the literature of antiquity that they rediscover. Be it Greek or Roman thought, the educators of the Renaissance embrace a much softer hand with regard to discipline in education. However, when you get to the Protestant Reformation, you see a whole cloth transformation into a much more strident paradigm of educational discipline. And so you see that kind of enduring influence throughout the South, that there is very much a biblically tempered and particularly a Protestant tempering of the ideas of discipline. And I don't think that we ever fully escape that. Of course, we're not alone. You can interchange Christian Protestantism with many other global religious traditions and come to similar ends.
As someone who's been interested in these sorts of topics academically, you've also had law enforcement experience. What, if anything, did you find fascinating or that you didn't expect from this research?
One of the things that I think that we can say, the police in our society have a unique competence in that they are granted an almost exclusive right to use non-negotiable coercive force in the completion of the tasks that society has assigned them. In other words, the police can make you do something that you might not otherwise wish to do. And physical compulsion is a common element of that. And so constituent to that is the whole question of acceptable force. And that plays right in to our notions about corporal punishment.
I think oftentimes when people want to debate the topic of corporal punishment or certain practices, we look at it only in terms of definitions and practices, but in many ways it's also about feelings, the thoughts we get when we see certain practices, or how we feel when certain things are done, or how we do not act or do not respond when we see things done to other people.
Well, I think there are some very clear policy implications that can flow out of this kind of research. In the book, I use the analogy of a pool table. And in many regards, you can think of punishment as a pool table. The balls are individuals in society. A ball is shot against a rail. The rail is like punishment that rebounds the individual back into the play of the collective. But the pockets, they're another position on the punishment switch. They remove the individual from the social play. Well, corporal punishment is interesting in that it provides another option. John Braithwaite coined the term reintegrative shaming. And corporal punishment can do that. The idea of don't be that guy. You know, you're being punished publicly so that you can be returned to the collective. Well, corporal punishment can serve another purpose. And we have described it as subjugative shaming. Corporal punishment can be used to reassert the social marginality of minority populations, and by that could be a racial and ethnic minority, it could be the peasantry, any group that we might think of as the social other. Corporal punishment can be used to reassert that difference. In looking at those places where corporal punishment persists, we can then start to examine the inequities in those societies and the full constellation of social arrangements and the distribution of power. Because at the end of the day, that's really what it's about, is one group staking claim to the social, legal, moral, political authority to subjugate through punishment any other portion of the population.
Dr. Matthew Pate is the author of Corporal Punishment Around the World. He's currently writing a book for the University of Arkansas Press that will be a complete history of prisons in Arkansas. In Little Rock, I'm Malcolm Glover.
This is Ozarks at Large. The University of Arkansas College of Engineering will host the Razorback Regional First Robotics Competition in April, April 4th, 5th, and 6th, inside Barnhill Arena on the U of A campus. More than 2,000 will participate. Volunteers are needed to help at all levels, from registration to assistance in the machine shop and on the practice field. Volunteers must be at least 13 years of age. If you'd like more information about the robotics competition in April, first.uark.com.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Ozark Mountain Daredevils helped craft the country roots rock sound of the 1970s, and the Springfield, Missouri-based group was created around the sound of an Arkansaser from the flat delta land of the southeast. John Dillon of Stuttgart was the only original member of the Ozark Mountain Daredevils who was playing professionally, and that was at a Springfield pizza parlor which drew students from Southwest Missouri State University. Dillon, who played guitar, mandolin, and dulcimer, showed local poet Steve Cash, another future daredevil, how to play harmonica. The Arkansas Countian said he taught Cash harmonica the same way his own mother had taught him, telling him to carry the instrument with him always.
Oh, country girl.
John Dillon also organized a weekly jam at a local theater when his friend Larry Lee, who played guitar, piano, and drums, became bartender. Other area musicians like pianist Buddy Brayfield, guitarist Randall Chowning, and bassist Michael Soup Granda, who sometimes wore a Superman costume, all learned each other's songs, but the future Ozark Mountain Daredevils reportedly didn't even consider themselves an actual band. The owner of the theater where the musicians played thought otherwise. He worked to get a live tape of the group to music impresario John Hammond, who financed a demo. A staff producer for A&M Records and Glenn Johns, who had produced the debut of the Eagles, both flew to Missouri to hear the musicians in concert. But under pressure, the band faltered in performance. Afterwards, the producers were convinced to hear a post-gig acoustic performance, and the down-home version of Standing on the Rock by Stuttgart's John Dillon sealed the deal with a major label. A year and a half after first playing together, the musicians, which surely thought of themselves as a real band by now, were recording their debut in London, England. The band's debut album, The Ozark Mountain Daredevils, reflected the group's new name, shortened from Cosmic Corncob and His Amazing Ozark Mountain Daredevils. The band found chart success quickly. If You Want to Get to Heaven, heard here and written by Arkansaser Dillon and Missourian Steve Cash, hit the top 25 in 1974. It remains a rock radio staple. With the biggest hit for the Ozark Mountain Daredevils came from their second album, It'll Shine When It Shines, named for another Dillon Cash composition. Although the album was recorded back home in Missouri, the album's true hit was a departure from the band's rootsy sound. Jackie Blue hit number 3 in early 1975 with a falsetto vocal and a modern pop sheen. Although the group was reluctant to leave Springfield, the Ozark Mountain Daredevils began to tour the world, and with some of the biggest names of the 1970s, Chicago, the Doobie Brothers, the Eagles, and others. The Ozark Mountain Daredevils continued performing and releasing albums through the 1970s. Dylan's Keep On Churning, heard here, is from the Daredevils' 1975 album, The Car Over the Lake. In 1977, theater owner Steve Canaday, who had cajoled John Hammond into hearing live tapes of the band in the first place, joined the group as the original lineup shifted. In 1978, Dylan and Cash appeared on a concept album about the American Civil War called White Mansions, with Waylon Jennings, Eric Clapton, and others. In 1980, the Ozark Mountain Daredevils switched to the label CBS for one unsuccessful album, and the group began to peter out and focus on solo projects. In the late 1980s, the Ozark Mountain Daredevils began performing and recording again and found an audience demand overseas. In 2000, A&M Records released a 21-track best of called Time Warp. In 2002, the band's long out-of-print catalog began to be reissued, with its third and fourth albums being released on CD. The Ozark Mountain Daredevils have never matched their early successes, but the nucleus of the original band, Missourian Steve Cash and Mike Granda, and Arkansas-er John Dylan, remain together into the 21st century. Here in its entirety is the title track from the 1974 second album from the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, It'll Shine When It Shines, co-written by Stuttgart, Arkansas's John Dylan.
The old cat on the roof, he could stand a little push, 'cause he's got nine good lives to live. But like my mama said, you only live till you're dead, and you got to give and give and give. There's a pebble in the pond going on and on, making waves and tides and ripples and rain. There's a leaf in the wind that don't know where to end, chasing days and ways and wishes and dreams. Seems like everyone is out looking for the sun, singing rain. Shine when it shines. You might think I'm wasting time, but I'm just a good old boy that's learned to wait.
Whippoorwill's in the dawn, pretty soon he'll be gone, and he's got one good song to sing. Like my daddy said, it's in your heart, not your head, and you got to sing and sing and sing. There's a window in the wall, looking out on it all, leaving fears and tears and troubles alone. A fire in the stove, keeping out the cold, warm and wine and winters and babies and homes.
Seems like everyone is out looking for the sun, singing rain. You might think I'm wasting time, but I'm just a good old boy. Yes, I'm just a good old boy that's learned the way.
It'll Shine When It Shines from the 1974 second album by the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, co-written by Stuttgart, Arkansas's John Dillon. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook. With Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Paris. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Tomorrow on the Wednesday, January 2nd, 2013 edition of Ozarks at Large, Arkansas is among a handful of states to offer GED tutoring and testing at absolutely no cost. But by 2014, the federal program will be privatized and digitized, and students will be charged a hefty fee. GED providers across Arkansas are expecting a surge of applicants before that fee is enacted. We'll visit a local GED center housed at the former Jefferson Elementary School in South Fayetteville to learn about the changes. That and much more on tomorrow's all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks so much for listening to this New Year's Day. Hope everything has gone well for you so far in 2013. Don't forget to have your black-eyed peas. I'm Kyle Kellums. Have a good Tuesday.
Forgot and days of old lang syne. For